languages of children. Part one will be presented this evening on BBN's conference pulpit with our speaker, Dr. Gary Chapman. He's the best-selling author of the Five Love Languages book and series. He's the director of Marriage and Family Life Consultants. With his extensive pastoring and marriage counseling experience, he travels the world presenting seminars to couples who want to improve their marriage relationship. In addition to his busy writing and seminar schedule, Dr. Chapman is the senior associate pastor of Calvary Baptist Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where he has served for nearly 50 years. Here is Dr. Gary Chapman with part one of The Five Love Languages of Children.
I assume if you're here, you have children. Okay. Are you anticipating children? Or maybe you're a grandparent, you have grandchildren. But if you have grandchildren, that means you had children, right? Okay. Well, I do believe that children are a gift of God. And I believe that basically all parents love their children. Maybe I should say most parents love their children. There are some parents, I think, you know, who are either mentally don't have the ability to love, or they're on drugs and alcohol and don't have the ability to love. But basically, parents love their children. But the reality is that not all children feel loved. And there's a huge difference between loving children and children feeling love. So what I want to talk tonight is about how do you effectively love children. I like to picture inside every child there is an emotional love tank. And if the love tank is full, that is if they genuinely feel loved by the parents, then the child grows up normally. But if the love tank is empty and the child does not feel loved by the parents, the child grows up with many internal struggles. And in the teenage years, the child will go looking for love, typically in all the wrong places. When I wrote my original book for married couples, The Five Love Languages, I included a chapter on how that concept applies to children. And for the next several years, I had so many parents say to me, you know, Dr. Chapman, you gave us a little bit of help in that book with children, but why don't you write a book that would really kind of elaborate on that idea? So I teamed up with Dr. Ross Campbell, a psychiatrist, 30 years experience working with children and adolescents, and we wrote the book, The Five Love Languages of Children. And I've been super, super encouraged by the response of that book and the number of parents almost every week who tell me that it has really made a huge difference in the way they love their children. So what I discovered was that the same five love languages that apply in a love relationship between a husband and wife also apply in the parenting relationship between the parent and the child, and that children really do have a primary love language. And if you don't speak their primary love language, they will not feel loved, even though you are speaking some of the other languages. So I want to, first of all, go through the love languages with you. They're not new to you if you've read the original book, but I want to show you how they apply to children, and I want to demonstrate to you the reality that children do have a primary love language, and we want to talk about how to discover that so that you can be effective in loving your children. So let's look at it. What are the five love languages? Let's begin. It's no particular order for these, but let's begin with physical touch. We've long known the emotional power of physical touch. Research has been done primarily in European orphanages that demonstrate that children who are picked up and touched tenderly develop better emotionally than children who are left for hours in a crib and no one touches them. This is why we encourage parents to pick up babies, to hold them, to kiss them, to cuddle them. And long before the baby understands the meaning of the word love, the baby feels love by physical touch. You remember in Mark chapter 10, when they brought the little children to Jesus, and his disciples said, No, this is not a kid's meeting, it's for adults. But what did Jesus say? Bring the little children to me, for of such is the kingdom of God. And the next verse says, he put his hands on them and touched them. Physical touch is a powerful communicator. Infants actually thrive on touch. As they get older, obviously the form of touch changes. As they get older, we're wrestling them in the floor, we're putting arms around them, we're kissing them, we're hugging them, and we get older, we're playing ball with them, we're giving them high fives. And let me just throw this out to fathers. Many fathers in our generation are drawing back from physically touching their pre-adolescent daughters. And I think the reason for that is we've had so much in the news about sexual abuse, and fathers just, they don't want to do anything wrong, and so they kind of draw back from touching their pre-adolescent daughters. But I'm telling you, if you don't hug your pre-adolescent daughter and kiss her on the cheek, she will find a teenage boy 3 years older than her who will. So I'm encouraging you, don't draw back from touching your pre-adolescent daughter. Continue to hug and continue to kiss. And let me just say that all of these languages can certainly be means of expression of love to all children. So we're not just going to limit it to the one that's primary, but we're going to give heavy doses of that. All children need to be touched. And I want to encourage you to continue touching your pre-adolescent daughters. But for some children, physical touch is their primary love language. I want to give you an example of this, and I won't do this on all of them, but one of the things we did in writing the book was we talked to children themselves, and we asked them questions such as, on a scale of 0 to 10, how much love do you feel from your father, or how much love do you feel from your mother? And other questions to try to solicit that. Now, here's an example of children for whom physical touch is their primary language. Sophia is 7. Quote, I know my mommy loves me because she hugs me. Jeremy is a junior in college. He told us how he knew his parents loved him. Quote, they showed it all the time. Every time I left the house, as long as I can remember, I always got a hug and kiss from my mom and a hug from my dad if he was at home. And every time I came home, it was a repeat performance. It's still that way. Some of my friends can't believe my parents because they didn't grow up in touching families, but I like it. I still look forward to their hugs. It gives me warm feelings inside. Obviously, for that young man, physical touch is his language. Here's an 11-year-old, Hunter. Quote, we ask him, on a scale of 0 to 10, how much do your parents love you? Without batting an eye, he said, 10. When we ask why, he said, quote, well, for one thing, because they tell me, but even more from the way they treat me. Dad is always bumping me when he walks by, and we wrestle on the floor. He's lots of fun, and Mom's always hugging me, although she stopped doing it in front of my friends. Jessica is 12. She lives with her mother most of the time and visits her father every other weekend. She said that she feels especially loved by her father. When we asked why, she said, quote, because every time I go to see him, he hugs and kisses me and tells me how glad he is to see me. When I leave, he hugs me for a long time and tells me he misses me. I know my mom loves me too. She does lots of things for me, but I wish she would hug me and act as excited about being with me as Daddy does. You understand the difference? She's feeling more love from the father for one reason. He's giving her more physical touch, and that's obviously her primary language. A second love language is words of affirmation, using words to affirm the child. Now, in all of the languages, there are different dialects, much as in spoken language. All of us grow up speaking a language with a dialect. I grew up speaking English, Southern style. But everyone grows up speaking a language with a dialect. So within these languages, there are different dialects. And on this particular one, I'm going to give you two or three of the dialects. I won't do that on all of them. But one of them would be words of affection. Affection. That is, words that focus on who the child is. But you can focus on the child's personality, or on their physical appearance, or on their value. But what you're trying to do is you're focusing on them. Not something they've done, but just them. Such things as, you are so beautiful. I love your strong muscles. I like the fact that you smile. You look so beautiful when you smile. You are really smart. I like the way you think. Or simply, I love you. It's just focusing on something about the child himself or herself. Words of affection. Now, when a child is an infant, it's the tone of voice that communicates love, not the words. You can say to an infant, "You sweet little thing, I just love you to death." Or you can say, "You little rascal, you just like your daddy." Yeah. It doesn't matter what you say. It's the tone of voice. But as they get older, of course, the words themselves become extremely important. And then a second dialect is words of praise. Now, this focuses on the child's effort. Great catch. Good job. You worked hard on this. But now let me remind you to always focus on effort, not on perfection. I remember I was visiting a 13-year-old boy in the hospital who had stomach ulcers. And I was trying to find out what might be going on inside of him. And I said to him in conversation, what kind of relationship do you and your father have? And I was surprised by his answer. He said, "I don't ever please my father." And I said, "Really?" I said, "Can you give me an example?" He said, "If I play ball and I make a double, my father will say, 'You should have made a triple, boy. Can't you run?'" He said, "If I make a B on my report card, my father will say, 'You should have made an A, boy. You're smarter than this.'" He said, "If I mow the grass, my father will say, 'You didn't get under the bushes, boy.'" I don't ever please my father. Now, I knew the boy's father, and I knew what he was trying to do. He was trying to motivate his son to give 100%. If you play ball, play ball. If you mow grass, do it right. You know the old saying, if a job's worth doing, it's worth doing right? My father told me that. If a job's worth doing, it's worth... And I knew that's what he was trying to do. And he was trying to communicate to his son, if you're capable of making A's, don't come home with B's. He was trying to motivate his son. But do you understand what his son was hearing? "I don't ever please my father." You see, the time to help a child bring a B to an A is not the day you bring the report card home. That's the day you praise them for the B. Yay, B! It's 3 days after the report card is back on the teacher's desk that you say, "Johnny, Mary, you know that B was really great. I wonder what we could do to bring it up to an A-. And they're with you. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. "Dr. Chapman, I could do that if it were a B." But it's kind of hard to praise a kid for a D. Well, do you know that a D is better than a D-? And a D- is better than an F? Yay! D! Woo! That's good, man! And it's 3 days later you say, "I wonder how we could bring that D up to a D+ next time." And the time to teach a child how to stretch a double into a triple is not the day he hits the double. It's next Saturday when you say to him, "You know, son, sometimes you can stretch a double into a triple. And you can show him how to run and slide into third base. And if you don't break your ankle, you can teach him how to do it." And the time to teach a child how to get the grass under the bushes is not the day he finishes mowing the grass. That's the day you praise him for all the grass that has been mowed. "Woo, look at all this grass lying flat. Man, you did a good job." It's next Saturday, you say. "Son, you see this grass under the bushes? It's hard to get. You have to go in and out, but I know you can do it." You bet he will. Are you with me? You reward children for effort. Now, you see, we do this when they're little. You remember when your child was learning how to walk? And they held onto the chair, and you got 2 feet away and said, "That's right, come on, you can walk, come on, you can walk, come on, you can walk." And they take half a step and fall. Now, what do you say when they fall? You don't say, "You dumb kid, can't you walk?" We say, "Yay!" And what happens? They get up and try again. We rewarded their effort. So when you're praising children, you don't praise them for perfection. You praise them for effort. And incidentally, ladies, this works really well with your husband. And all the guys are saying, amen. You see, you walk into the room of a six-year-old, and you tell him, let's say, to pick up your toys and put them in the toy box. And you go back in 10 minutes, and seven toys are in the box, and five are on the floor. What are you going to say? I told you to get these toys up, boy, and I get them out now. Why not? Yay, seven in the box! And I bet the other five will jump in the box. You see, praising children for effort is a far more powerful way to motivate them and to communicate love to them. And then a third dialect of words is words of encouragement. The word encourage means to instill courage. You're trying to give them the ability, the motivation to attempt to do more. Such things as, that's close, man. You almost got it. You're almost there, man. That's good. Hey, you got it. I noticed the way that you shared your clay with Mary. It was really neat, man. I love it when you share. Or, you know, I noticed the way you went over and encouraged Mark after he missed that shot. I know he must have felt badly, and I really appreciate that about you, that you went over there and gave him a word of encouragement. You are encouraging him to do something that you believe to be worthwhile. So what you're doing is trying to catch your children doing things that you would like to build into their character, and you affirm them for that, and it encourages them to do that even more. And let me just say this out, one little guideline on the words, I love you, because these are words of affirmation. They're probably the most common words of affirmation. But the words, I love you, to a child should always stand alone. It should not be, I love you, will you do this for me? It should not be, I love you, but I'll tell you right now. It should not be, I love you when you clean up your room. I love you when you make good grades. Or I love you, I would love you if you would break up with that creep you're dating. No, the message is, I love you no matter what. I don't always like what you do, but I will always love you, and I will always be here for you. You see, again, We can say that when they're young, but when they get to be 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, we don't always like what they're doing, and we have a hard time saying simply, I love you, I will always love you. It's okay to say, I don't like what you're doing. It's okay to say that to a 14-year-old or 15-year-old, but I will love you, and I will always be here for you. You see, if they sense that in their heart, when they get into trouble, they will come to you because they know in their heart you will love them no matter what they've done. If they don't have that sense, then when they get in trouble, they will go to their friends or somebody else for help because they don't think that you'll be there for them. Melissa is 8. She said, quote, I love my mother because she loves me. Every day she tells me that she loves me. I think my father does too, but he never tells me. For that gal, words is her primary language. Taylor's 12. She broke her arm this year. Quote, I know that my parents love me because when I was having such a hard time keeping up with my schoolwork, they encouraged me. They never forced me to do homework when I wasn't feeling well, but told me I could do it later. They said how proud they were that I was trying so hard and that they knew I would be able to keep up. You see, words of encouragement were powerful to her. David is an active, outspoken 5-year-old, confident that his parents love him. Quote, my mama loves me and my daddy loves me. Every day they say, I love you. John is 10. He's been in foster homes since he was 3. For the past 8 months, he has lived with Doug and Betsy, his fourth set of foster parents. When he was asked if they genuinely loved him, He said they did. We asked why he said that so quickly. Quote, because they don't yell and scream at me. My last foster parents yelled and screamed all the time. They treated me like trash. Doug and Betsy treat me like a person. I know I have lots of problems, but I also know they love me. Words can be powerful to a child. As a matter of fact, the book of Proverbs says, life and death are in the power of the tongue. You can kill a child, or you can give a child life by the way you talk to them. And incidentally, the same thing is true with your spouse. Ladies, when you give your husband a positive word, there's something inside of him that wants to be better. And when you give him a critical word, there's something inside of him that wants to shoot you. A third love language is quality time. Giving the child your undivided attention, quality time. Have you mothers and fathers ever had this experience? You're making potato salad, and your three-year-old son or daughter comes and says, hey, Mommy, hey, Daddy, come to my room, Daddy. I want to show you something. Let's go play, Dad. Let's go play. And you say, okay, well, let me finish the potato salad, and then we'll go play. And they come back in 2 minutes. Well, Mommy, come on. Let's play, Mommy. Let's play, Daddy. And you say, okay, honey, let me finish the potato salad. And they come back 4 or 5 times. They're begging for quality time. Now, wouldn't it be better to give the child quality time and then say, now Mommy or Daddy has got to go fix the potato salad. And because you fill their love tank, they'll let you fix the potato salad in peace. Or a father is sitting there, comes home, and he's sitting there reading the newspaper, or he's working on his computer, and the kid comes and, hey, Daddy, come. Hey, Dad, come, you know. And the daddy says the same similar thing, you know. And then what happens eventually? They jump into the paper. They jump on your computer. They're begging you for quality time. So far better to give them quality time if you know that this is their language. The important thing is not what you are doing. The important thing is that the child has your undivided attention. When they're little, and let me just say this, that you have to go to where the child is in order to give them quality time. So when they're little, it means you go to the floor because that's where they are. You remember this? You're sitting on the floor and you have your legs spread and they're over there and you have a ball and you say, whee! That's right. Whee! That's right. Good. Whee! That's right. Good. Whee! You run a $1 million business, but right now this child has your undivided attention. Now if the telephone rings and you start talking on the phone while you roll the ball, the child no longer has your undivided attention. Now, as they get older, again, you go to where they are. It may be the sandbox. It may be tricycles. It may be bicycles. It may be ball. But you go to where they are. They cannot come to where you are. And if you're going to spend quality time, you have to go to where they are. Now, this may involve quality conversation. That's one of the dialects, quality conversation. You're not just giving them undivided attention in a game. You are actually having a conversation with them. You know, we often miss opportunities for conversation by the way we respond to a child. For example, a child brings home their art piece from school, and they want you to see it, and you look at it and say, oh, honey, that's beautiful. Oh, I love the colors. Oh, you did a good job with that. Now, all of those are words of affirmation. They're all good. But when you get through with the praise, the conversation's over. There really was no conversation. It was a monologue. But if you said to the child, after you've said those affirming words, honey, what were you thinking when you drew this? Or what were you feeling when you drew this? They'll tell you. I was thinking about last summer when we were at grandmother's house and had a picnic under the tree. And this is the dog. Remember, he ate my hot dog. I didn't like him at first, but I like him now. And they go on to tell you about their picture and what they were thinking, what was in their mind, and what they were feeling. And then you can interact with them, and you're having a conversation. So You have to make conversation with children. They're willing to enter into it, but we have to be thinking conversation. Storytelling is another way to spend quality time with children. Storytelling. They can be real stories. They can be Bible stories. Or you can make up stories. I remember when our kids were little, we have a son and a daughter. I remember when they were little, I had this whole series of stories I used to tell about a man named Squirrel and a squirrel named Man. You can go a lot of places with that. Everybody has the ability to tell stories. And they also love to hear when you were a little boy and when you were a little girl and what your mother did and all those kind of things. It's wonderful opportunities in telling your story to your kids to spend quality time with them. Now, you know, when they're little, we don't have a whole lot of trouble of going where they are. But when they get to be teenagers, we don't always want to go where they are. But I'm going to tell you, if you're going to spend time with your teenager, you have to go to where they are. If you go to where your kids are, you can walk with them through those teenage years, and you can spend quality time with them. But if you draw a line in the sand and say, I'm not going there, then they go there with somebody else. So I encourage you to spend quality time with your kids all along the way. Then number four is receiving gifts. Gifts. I mentioned earlier that my academic background, undergrad and a master's degree, is in anthropology, cultural anthropology. We have never discovered a culture where gift giving is not an expression of love. It's universal to give gifts as an expression of love. The gift says, he was thinking about me. Look what he gave me. Now, the gifts need not be expensive. Haven't we always said it's the thought that counts? But I remind you, it's not the thought left in your head. It's the gift that came out of the thought in your head. How many mothers have ever received a dandelion from your kids? Yeah, okay? Yeah, it didn't cost anything, but that kid was thinking about you and brought you that dandelion. You can pick up a stone in a city parking lot and take it home and give it to an 8-year-old boy and say, hey, man, look what I found today. I thought about you. Look at those colors in there, man. I wanted you to have this. I can almost guarantee you, you'll find it in their dresser drawer when they're 23. And they'll remember the day you gave it to them. It doesn't have to be expensive gifts. I was in Germany some time ago. I was there with NATO. And I had a free afternoon. And I was just kind of walking around the base. And I noticed a young man. He appeared to be 13, maybe. He was sitting on a park bench by himself. And so I just kind of walked up to him and started talking to him. And I noticed he had around his neck a St. Christopher medallion. I didn't know what it was, but I noticed he had a medallion. And so I said to him, I said, well, what's your medallion? He said, it's St. Christopher. I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, my father gave it to me before he was deployed. And he told me to wear it and remember him. I said, oh, that's neat. I said, who was St. Christopher? He said, he was some saint in the church. You see, it was obvious to me, it didn't have a lot of religious significance, but it had a whole lot of emotional significance because his father gave it to him, and he was wearing it. So gifts can be powerful communicators. Now, let me throw this in. Even if your child's love language is gifts, you don't give them everything they want. You're the parent. By and large, parents are older than children, and thus wiser than children. You don't give them everything they want. God doesn't give us everything we want. He's our Father. He loves us, but he doesn't give us everything we want. Had he done that for me, I'd have married the wrong woman, because I told him which one I wanted. And she walked away, you know. Thank God he doesn't give us everything we ask for. You know, a kid may want three cookies or three candy bars for lunch, but you're the parent. What we do is we give them what we believe is good for them, what we believe will enhance their life. And with today's world and all the stuff they see on television advertised and everything that all their friends have, they can bombard you with things that they've got to have because everybody else has it. You don't give children things just because everybody else has it. You're assessing whether this would be good for your child or not be good for your child. And because if gifts is their language, how much it costs and what it is relatively unimportant. It's the fact that you give them gifts. Now, sometimes parents don't get emotional credit for the gifts they give because they don't present them as gifts. For example, in the fall, most parents will buy their children some school supplies when school starts. Even sometimes buy them clothes, new clothes. But they don't present them as gifts. The clothes, they clip off the tags, put them in the washer, fold them up, and put them in the drawer. And the school supplies, they just put in the backpack or whatever, and there's your school supplies. And the kid doesn't perceive it as a gift. It's just something that fell out of heaven, you know, into their drawers. Why not wrap them up, put a bow around them, give them out of the presence of the family, make it a big deal, and the kid gets the sense, they're giving me something. And let me just say this, the word gift comes from the Greek word charis, which means grace, unmerited favor. A gift is not something you give a child because they did something for you. You give it to the child simply because you love them. It's unmerited. You see, if you say to your child, I'll buy you that new ball if you'll clean your room. That's not a gift. That's payment for services rendered. The little boy next door will do that for you. No. A gift is not something that you give a child because they did something to please you. A gift is something you give them simply because you love them. It's not based on child's performance, but it's simply because you love them. And let me just throw this out. And this is particularly for parents that are living apart and you're sharing the custody of a child. Don't try to buy the affection of your child by giving them gifts. This is most often by the non-custodial parent who doesn't see the child very much, but when they do, they shower them with gifts that the custodial parent cannot afford. And it's an effort to kind of make up for the hurt they've brought in the child's life, and it almost never works. But far better to find out the child's primary love language, speak that language, and don't think that buying kids things will take care of, you know, healing in their lives, because it doesn't. Then number five is acts of service. Acts of service. This involves doing things for our children. Now, we start this and we speak this language from the day they're born, serving them. We put the food in and we take the food out. If you don't, they will die. So we do this from the very, very beginning. Acts of service should then be appropriate to the age. You know, when they're just learning to eat with a spoon, it's okay for you to fly the food into their mouth like a plane, you know, on the whoop, good, yeah, whoop, good. That's okay when they're learning. But you shouldn't be doing that when they're five, you know. We first of all do things for them they cannot do for themselves. And then as they get older, we teach them how to do things for themselves. And that is also an act of service. Six-year-olds can make up their own bed if you teach them how to do it. There's a whole lot of things at every age that they can do for themselves if you teach them how to do it. Now, I don't have to tell you that it often takes more time and energy to teach a child how to do something than it does to do it for them. And that's why some parents do everything for their children until they're 18 years of age. They send them off to the university, and they don't know how to do anything. I mean, Wake Forest University is in our city. And when I had our college ministry and directed it years ago, We would go out on campus and meet every freshman student. We'd go to the dorms and we'd knock on the door and we'd say, we're from the name of our church and we're just visiting on the dorms and welcoming freshmen to campus. You got a few minutes to talk. And we never had anybody turn us away because freshmen are looking for somebody to talk to them. But you know what I found? 6 weeks into the first semester, something happens that's never happened in their whole life, especially if they're guys. All their clothes get dirty at the same time. They're all piled up at the end of the bed, and you can smell them before you see them. And his mother never taught him how to run a washing machine. And finally, some guy will come along and say, "Hey, man, come on, we got washing machines down here. Come on, I'll show you how it works." So he takes him down there and shows him where you put the quarters in, where you put the soap in. But he walks off too soon. And the young guy puts it all in there together, the black and the green and the white, and they all come out orange. And then he says, "What's wrong with your water down here in North Carolina?" Yeah. Folks, they don't teach you how to run a washing machine at the university. You got to learn that at home. That's why I suggest to parents that some juncture along the way, you sit down and make out a list of what you'd like for your child to be able to do by the time they're 18. And if they're teenagers, you let them help you. What would they like to learn by the time they get ready to leave home? And then you begin operating on that list at whatever age they are. And your objective is that by 18, I want them to be able to make it on their own because they're going to be out there on their own at the university. And incidentally, you have to teach them how to make decisions because they're going to make decisions at the university. That's why I suggest to parents way down here, you start teaching children how to make decisions. And one of the best ways is to give them options. You know, you say, "Johnny, you want to bring your tricycle in before we eat or after we eat?" Either one of the decisions is going to be fine with you, but you're letting the child make decisions, and they get a feel for making decisions, okay? And then you also let them know that that there are guidelines and rules. If you don't bring your tricycle in or your bicycle in at night and you leave it out overnight, then you can't ride it the next day. That's a fair rule, isn't it? And so they left it out. You don't go screaming at them and say, "Better get out there and get your bicycle." You told them the rule. Just let it ride. And the next day, they don't get to ride the bicycle. They won't miss but one day. They'll bring the bicycle in. So you're teaching them that with every decision, there are consequences. So we express love to them by acts of service, doing things for them and then teaching them how to do things for themselves. And the good part about this is, for the parent, as they get older, it gives you a whole lot of help. You don't have to do all the vacuuming and all the everything, you know. And you know, anybody here still cook? Yeah, my son didn't get married till he was 34. And people would ask him, "When are you going to get married?" He said, "You know, when you grow up in the home of a marriage counselor, you're very careful." But he came to me about 6 months after he got married. He said, "Dad, I got a bonus when I married Amy." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, Dad, she cooks. I never thought I'd find a girl that cooked. And then my daughter married a man that cooks. So my kids got it made." Yeah. And now our granddaughter's 13. And this year she said, she called us and said, "I want you and Mama to come down." She said, "I'm going to cook Thanksgiving for you." 13. Yeah, my daughter and her husband, they don't let the kids watch a whole lot of TV, but she can watch the cooking channel, you know. And her father's a real good cook, and he's taught her to cook, and he's teaching the boy to cook. Man, I'm going to have great grandkids. When they get married, somebody's going to get a bonus in those kids. They're going to be able to cook. And yes, it takes a lot of time to do that, but it's one of the love languages of children.
This has been Conference Pulpit from BBN, and this evening we listened to part one of the message, The Five Love Languages of Children. Our speaker this week is Dr. Gary Chapman. Say, are you a child of God? Do you know what it means to be born again, born into God's family? Perhaps you have questions and doubts concerning these biblical terms of regeneration, redemption, being born again. allow us to bring clarity to you through bbnchat.org tonight. bbnchat.org. In our online chat ministry, we have biblical advisors who will be able to share from Scripture how to trust Christ as your Savior.